This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your It Is What It Is Till It Ain't Anymore of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Here's what he'll do. He'll play cool when he hangs out with a woman like you. Say he ain't pressed by all your success. Tell you he's different than all the rest.
That is Breadwinner off the new Kacey Musgraves album, Star-Crossed. Breadwinner, a bracing and barbed tale of what it means to be the person in the relationship providing a certain sort of stability and how that can be interpreted by someone who lacks that stability. Kacey's back with her fifth album. Later in the show, Laura Snapes is going to call in. We're going to talk about the long arc of Kacey's career and whether it is okay for Kacey to, at this point in her career, put out records that are both big and small, which is something that the public does not seem inclined to want her to do, but may well be the thing that she's doing. We're going to talk about that with Laura. But first, Amanda Hess is calling in. Amanda, my colleague, our critic at large, flew down to Nashville to hang with Kacey, spend a little time talking to her about what the last couple of years have been like, and was in the room when Kacey got an interesting FaceTime request. So let's kick it off. Amanda Hess, critic at large in the New York Times. Hello, welcome back to Popcast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Should we unearth the trauma before we get in? All right. Okay. You please. It's all you. The floor is yours.
Well, the last time I was on the podcast, the only time it was so you could reprimand me for wearing AirPods, which I'm wearing as we speak yet again. I feel like they've only grown in ubiquity since we last talked. So I'm sorry.
Wait, but are you coming on podcast and suggesting that popularity is a good proxy for quality? Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm trying to commiserate with you as, you know, everybody else moves on without you. And you're just stuck there with whatever string is attached to the headphones that you're wearing.
Okay, so I have a corded headphones that are plugged into my 1977 Macintosh first generation laptop, which is then plugged into the microphone, which is plugged into a three-pronged plug, which is plugged into a two-prong converter, which is plugged into an old outlet on the wall. So we're just lucky I don't get electrocuted every week when we do podcasts. That's like the bare minimum. But you know what? The thing that I like most about podcasts is you don't have to agree with me to be on podcast. You just have to believe in what you believe. Unless you are,
I'm not trying to sell Apple. I'm just saying.
Do you have a discount code? Amanda Hess 20 at checkout? Okay.
AH loves Apple. I'm just saying that I wear them.
Here's the thing. I want you to be in the healthiest relationship with your audio products that you can arrive at. And if this is where that has landed, it brings me joy.
I appreciate it, John.
It's generosity all around. Kacey Musgraves, corded AirPods. Like, what do we think?
I think AirPods.
I low-key think corded, TBQH.
I'm sure she wears a variety of headphones in different contexts, I would say.
Yes, that's true. She is flexible. She is headphone flexible. You had the fortune of getting on a plane, I presume, unless maybe you drove, but maybe got on a plane and going to Nashville, kicking it with Kacey Musgraves for a profile that came out a few weeks ago. Talk to me a little bit about, before you went, what were the questions that were burning in your ears underneath the AirPods? What were the questions that were burning that you felt like you had to get to the bottom of?
First, my main objective was to not get breakthrough COVID when I went, and I did not get breakthrough COVID, so that was great. But before,
I'm sure the union would have protected you if you had gotten a breakthrough COVID infection and had to
send me some flowers at least. I've been listening to Kacey Musgraves for many years, and I am an admirer of her music. And one of the things that I love so much about her is her ambivalence and her skepticism as a writer and an artist. And so when I was heading down there, I asked Karen Gans, my editor on the story. Let's give it up for her.
Gans Core.
Yes, Gans-core. Huge fan of her as well. And I was interested in what Karen was interested in. And she said, it seems like the label is positioning her to be less of a country artist and more of a pop artist. And is that what she wants? Or does she want to keep trucking and doing what she's doing?
Taking drugs, writing songs.
Yeah. And so I was kind of interested in whether an ambivalent person can become a huge pop star and whether that kind of person wants that and what that even means or looks like.
Whether they can become bivalent, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. You've done profiles before. I've done profiles before. Every now and again, you're hanging out with someone and like a thing happens that's so specific and perfect for the narrative that you're almost just like, is this real? Like, is this like a plant? Like, was there a plan to make this happen? Can you please talk through the moment in your story which falls under this umbrella?
So I was hanging with Kacey and her two producers in their garage studio in Nashville, and Kacey got a call, a FaceTime on her phone. And I didn't know who it was, and she showed the screen to her fellow producer, and she was like, I'm not going to answer it. And he was like, no, you should answer it. And so she answered it. And for, I would say, John, 5 minutes, I did not know who it was. And then ultimately it became clear that she was talking to Justin Bieber.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, it was a little too perfect because I had come with this question, you know, what is her orientation toward pop stardom? And to have a conversation with her and pop stardom incarnate in the story is obviously, you know, it's very helpful for answering that question.
Although I would actually say, sidebar, Justin Bieber himself pretty ambivalent about pop stardom.
It did seem that way when I was listening to their conversation. It did become clear to him that I was a New York Times reporter who was there. So he knew that I was there.
Did he ask about me?
You didn't. John, you didn't come up.
I'm just playing.
You didn't come up. But this story was then later picked up by some kind of gossipy press, you know, where they take like one little thing out of your story and make it into a thing. It's like, you know, Justin Bieber FaceTimes Kacey Musgraves. And I want to set the record straight because I feel like I didn't make it clear, and I felt like I didn't need to make it clear that he was not FaceTiming her in a romantic context.
Oh, clearly. Like, yeah. That was clear to me.
Obvious to me that it would be bizarre for me to clarify. But no, he was calling her and talking to her about how much he and his wife love listening to her music and also about how badly he wishes to collaborate with her. So that is what they were talking about.
Wait, where's that detail in the story? Why is that the why is that got to be? I mean, I'm grateful for the bonus footage. Don't get me wrong. But
I'm breaking news on the podcast.
Oh, my
today.
Gosh. Oh, we're going to get so many retweets. This is big.
This is going to be great. Big.
I like her casualness, which is you freaking love an unannounced FaceTime, dude. That's what she says to him, as quoted in your story, which what that says to me is, boy, be doing this a lot. There's a level of comfort between them where he's just like, whatevs, I'm Justin Bieber. I could FaceTime whoever I want at any moment. And she's just like, hey, sometimes I'm going to pick up and sometimes I'm not. And I'm going to let you know it's a little weird that you do that.
Which, again, you know, of course, very helpful for my story, which is that, you know, sometimes it seems like she's interested in being a pop star and sometimes she doesn't. Although when I asked her point blank, she said, no, I do not want to be a pop star.
I will say that I've never thought she wanted to be a pop star. I'm glad that she's talking about that because I feel like sometimes the narrative of the last album and the kind of like oh, she's escaping the gravitational pull of Nashville, yada, yada, yada. As if there's only, number one, one way to do that. Like, you can only end up as a pop star. But also, number two, as if Nashville or country music isn't actually like an extraordinarily big tent that holds like any number of things. It's just not what's played on the radio per se, but it's not as if there aren't dissenters working in and around the Nashville system, often right next door to the people who are the true centrists. So that's always felt like a truer narrative.
She has such a more interesting story than this reductive one that I do also retell in this piece, which is like, it's not just that she's country and maybe is becoming less country. She always had this very specific point of view that was, as someone who grew up as a child yodeler coming from Texas and then making these albums that were so wry and pointed and loved the place that she came from, but also made fun of it and distanced herself from it. And for me, the question is, after she's done making these albums about how she's outgrown her hometown to the point where she's outgrown making albums about outgrowing her hometown, where is she going to go next? Because she's such an interesting artist. And I guess you can tell me more about where you think she's gone, because I may be one of the only podcast guests who texts Joe Coscarelli when I'm writing about music and says, Joe, can you describe what this music sounds like to me? Because it's one of my weak points.
It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, but I would follow her anywhere, Casey.
And just for the record, it remains, even at my advanced critical age, it remains a hard thing to do. Maybe people don't text Joe Coscarelli, but maybe they text somebody else. So, right. so don't worry about that. Don't worry about that.
Well, I did ask her. I also asked her if she had considered physically moving out of Nashville because she just bought a new house there. And she said the place that she's felt pulled toward is Japan. And that's the one place that she's sort of considered skipping town for. And she wanted to record some of this album there, obviously. International COVID, yeah. Events got in the way of that. But, you know, the thing that she said about playing in Japan, she's played there several times over the past few years. And to her, it was sad that artists coming out of Nashville and country artists, you know, hadn't been bringing their music there. And when she did bring her music there, she found that she had this very warm reception. That also, you know, complicates to me this idea of how much do you have to change about yourself in order to become a global star, and how much do you just have to go around the world?
Casey is an interesting case of someone who assembled a fan base largely outside of what we would think of as existing, whether it's demographic or genre, boxes. And in the current internet ecosystem, where people often feel loyal to a person more than a sound or an idea, what you said is right. She carries them with them. She carries those people with her. You just said you'll go wherever she goes. And that's how I think a lot of people feel about Casey. I think those people probably don't have loads of anxiety over whether she's going to get played on country radio. I think there are people in Nashville who have anxiety that someone like Kacey Musgraves functions the way she functions. But I think Kacey Musgraves fans don't have very much anxiety at all about whether Nashville gives a damn about what Kacey Musgraves is doing. That Venn diagram, there's not really overlap in those conversations, I don't think.
Radio is less and less of a concern, I mean, specifically to her. It also seems clear to me that whatever the algorithm is, hasn't quite caught up to her. And maybe it's even changed since her new album has come out. But when I went to Kacey Musgraves Radio on Spotify, it was all just contemporary country artists. And I asked her about that and she was like, I so wish I could program this myself. And I've had to just ignore it.
She better not say that, because then Spotify will make her do it. They don't tell her not to say that. I mean, to me, and I said this in my review, you know, this record to me feels much more in the Phoebe Bridgers reign. You know, I mentioned Japanese Breakfast. I certainly thought of Waxahachie. To me, this record feels closer tonally to those albums. You know, thematically, I think it could work really in either space. But in terms of how Casey does this, almost like a tug of war between traditionalist-minded, roots-oriented, or at least Roots embedded production with all these kind of additional flourishes that, like, maybe they're psychedelic, maybe they're disco, maybe they're schlocky pop. That tug of war is being done, I feel, quite a bit outside of quote unquote Nashville. It's just rare that someone who came up through that pipeline wants to do it. Also, you know, I mentioned Sturgill Simpson, who I think thinks of centrist country music and centrist Nashville probably very much similarly to how Casey does, and kind of was like, well, what can I slather my music in just to make it clear that, like, I'm not doing that thing?
I was also interested in what it's like to be in this limbo where, for instance, when she met her new boyfriend, they locked eyes across a restaurant and he didn't know who she was. But then when they step out together, there's like paparazzi. And so she is in this space where if you know who Kacey Musgraves is, you may be obsessed with her. But there are still a lot of people who don't. And that's certainly something that her labels are trying to move the needle on a little bit.
You didn't get the sense that she was particularly troubled by that.
She told me that she has this fear of becoming too famous. This fear of losing her, of not having her feet on the ground, of the music becoming bad because she's trying to be someone who she's not.
One of the things I think Kacey does so well is this kind of, I don't want to say perform, I don't mean performance like it's, she's performing it in like an overdetermined way, but performance of malaise, performance of soft-spoken, almost quasi-boredom. There's a little bit of like reluctance in sometimes how she approaches singing. And I think on this album, even songwriting sometimes. And it's not like she's ever done crazy, effusive, celebrity profile covers. She did do an Elle magazine cover, though. Shout out Veronique Hyland, who wrote that cover, which I thought was a really good story. But she's not doing Katy Perry type stuff. You know, it doesn't seem like she wants to do that. I wonder, when you were in conversation with her, how did she present conversationally? Was she effusive in conversation? Was she a little bit shy or reticent in conversation? Compared to other interview subjects, did you find yourself trying to draw her out? Did you find yourself following her? How did that go?
She's just like a nice, normal person. I mean, I don't know, you know?
I've never met one of those. I don't know what that's like.
Yeah, she doesn't feel like a construction of anything. When I met up with her and her producers, she was talking with them about recording this jazz standard by this person named Blossom Deary, who I had never heard of. Maybe you had. And so the thing she told me about what's great about her situation right now is that it's allowing her to pursue creative freedom, even if there is this like sort of bizarre industry structure being built up around her while she's doing it. And so she's like jamming to Blossom Deary while declining that Justin Bieber FaceTime. It's just this topsy-turvy kind of place that she's found herself in. She mentioned that she had only in the past few years developed a kind of form of stage fright. And it's really not of the stage, I guess. It's like it's a camera thing. It only comes up in televised stuff. And the first time that she noticed it was when she was filming this Christmas special. There was this unexpected thing where the crew was asking everyone to tell them their favorite Christmas memory. And it was like the camera was on her asking her to say something about herself. And she froze up and couldn't think of what to say. And she said that in person, like when she's just hanging out with a group of people, she's pretty reserved and shy. And sometimes people can perceive her as standoffish, or I think, you know, one thing she said is that people think she has resting bitch face, and she's like, to her, the explanation for that is that she is a reserved private person, and in her music, she says what she thinks, and that's her outlet for that. She's like, miss, follow your arrow. And so for people to be confronted by her as not this super chatty, opinionated thing is maybe unexpected.
A thing that I feel like I find myself having to explain to people sometimes is like being an aggressively public-facing person who embraces that spotlight and kind of like leans into it. That's a talent, you know, it's a skill, and it's also a choice. It's not simply that every person who is widely liked or admired naturally does that. There are plenty of ways to be reluctant in the spotlight, and I think she's proof of that. Even if the spotlight's stronger, it's not going to knock her off of the thing that she does.
And it's certainly something that appeals to me about her music, her sort of emotional orientation towards it, which has always been slightly off-kilter.
Let's listen to Good Wife off the new album. So this is a divorce album. I mean, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. You mentioned that she had just bought a new house or was moving to a new house. That's the house. That's her post-marriage house, which is something that has come up a little bit in the press. Did she talk at all about kind of the difference between writing a divorce album, between writing the last album, or how her approaches have evolved, or the challenges of that?
One of the things that was challenging for her about assembling this album is that she didn't write it as a divorce album. She started writing it while she was still married to her ex-husband. Good Wife was written while they were together. And so I was kind of like, you know, when you're when you're writing a song like Good Wife, is your husband like looking over your shoulder being like, hey, what are you writing about? Our marriage that is still happening right now. And she kind of dodged the question, but she did say that, you know, theirs was a marriage, you know, just to make it even more Nashville, a marriage of two singer-songwriters. And so it was very kind of clear from the beginning that they would be writing about each other. And it's bittersweet that, you know, she had this huge, incredibly successful album about how happy they were. And now she has this next album that's about how it didn't stay that way. Certainly, you know, I've seen a lot of people comment on the internet like, ooh, sorry about your divorce, but like really glad that I get to listen to the divorce album.
Vicious.
I know.
Although I will say, I didn't really write about this in my review, but it was something that I thought about a lot listening to this album. And comparing or contrasting it really to Golden Hour, I am actually in the rare camp that I kind of don't like how Golden Hour sounds. I know like people love it. It won the album of the year, the Grammys, et cetera, et cetera. It's a little, it always felt a little like overdetermined for me personally. But there is an exuberance kind of on that album, right? And then this album feels like very reluctant. And that tonal shift is actually really where it derives its power, I think, is in implicit dialogue or response to the last album. And that juxtaposition, that kind of like, I gave you all of this fullness 3 years ago, which could be true in music and it could be true in marriage, right? I gave you all this. I presented this full of color. And now I need to kind of like get back under the shell a little bit, like for myself.
I spoke with her and her producers about a particular song, Breadwinner, which is...
First of all, shout out Rob Arvilla, who like the minute the track listing for this album came out was basically like, if I was Rustin Kelly, I would literally be like
sweating.
The minute I saw the word breadwinner on this track listing, like I would be like in a camper, like driving off to some into the desert somewhere.
Yeah.
Nothing bad to say about Rustin Kelly. I'm just saying if you see that and you know it's about you, whoo, yeah, whoo.
And it's a song, as you might expect, it's about a guy who can't handle being with a woman who is that. And Casey and her producers were, I think, hesitant about even including it on the album. She told me that she wrote something like 40 songs that she considered putting on the album. And Breadwinner, she was even nervous that it might speak too loud emotionally compared to the rest of the songs. And I think she did want to honor the fact that she had all of these different emotions. This is not a revenge before he cheats kind of album, but I'm glad she put it on anyway.
The fact that that comes right in the middle of the album, like it is the pivot point of the record for me. It's really when the record wakes up in my mind, and it is on this album of, I think, very like gentle and a little bit restrained songwriting. It is the most crystalline of all the songwriting and therefore very deeply powerful. And I think without this song at the center of the record, I think the whole narrative maybe doesn't quite tie together. I don't know where Rustin is right now, but it's tough. He's feeling it. It's like hot breath on the back of his neck, and not in the good way. Like he's feeling it.
Yeah. I mean, I asked her when I met her, had he listened to it yet? And she said, well, the album hasn't come out yet. So no. So I heard it before he did. Must be an interesting lesson.
Deep sigh. Did Casey get any other FaceTimes from multi-platinum pop stars or hip hop stars, you know, country stars, any stars while you were hanging out and vibing?
She didn't. She told me she's a Billie Eilish fan, but they didn't speak while we were together.
Yo, that it. Okay. Casey Musgraves, Billie Eilish.
I'm here for it. Collab? I would love it.
I am here for that. They do very. That's interesting. Ooh, that's interesting. I like that. Those are two singers who maybe from a distance might not seem to have loads in common, but actually I think fundamentally have quite a lot in common.
I think they're on a similar wavelength.
Also, sidebar, if you've seen Billie Eilish's Jordan 15s, immaculate, great look, great collaboration.
John, Amanda, you'd be surprised to know that I have not.
Okay. I'll send you a picture. I'll text you a picture.
Okay, thank you.
Were there any other impressions that you were left with, you know, whether cutting room floor stuff or just like, you know how fraught the interview scenario can be. And, you know, sometimes people want to give a lot and sometimes they don't. But are there things that you walked away feeling were just like subcutaneous, just like a tiny bit, maybe unspoken about this moment in Casey?
I think partly because I have an almost 1-year-old son, and so I spent the past like year
adorable
and a half being thank you. I always got to fit him in there to any convo I can.
Very adorable. I saw you on the street a couple of months ago. I was like, damn, it's like better in person than on
thank
the
you
internet.
Thank
even
you
great.
But I've spent the past like year and a half like pregnant or breastfeeding, and so coming from that perspective, I was like, Casey, I really want to speak to you about drugs that I personally can't. do, but that I know you have. And she expressed to me like a little trepidation about feeling like she's being written into this role as like a dilettante druggy lady. And she's very much not.
She's not a dilettante or she doesn't?
She does do. She
she does drugs and she's not dilettante about it. She's committed.
She's used them in this very intentional way in her work.
She did a guided psilocybin trip that's part of this album process.
Yeah, it was. And in the L story that you mentioned, it talks about this psilocybin playlist that she listened to while she was on the trip. And one of the songs on it is Gracias a la Vida, which is the final song on the album. She does a cover of it, and she, you know, listened to that while she was doing that. So that's where that came from. I did ask her, Casey, do you ever listen to Casey Musgrave songs while you're on a trip? And she was like, oh no, like I would be so happy if other people did that. She would be thrilled, but she was like, I can't. To me, it's like, you know, the scene in Being John Malkovich where John Malkovich goes into John Malkovich, something like that. So she stays away.
Okay, so two things. We are not advocating drug use on this podcast. That said, if anybody wants to listen to Popcast on a guided trip, tell me how that goes. I'd be really curious to know. Amanda, I appreciate you tapping in with us. And let's listen to Gracias a la Vida in whatever state we happen to be in right now. How's that?
Thanks for having me, John.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto. Me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Hi, it's Samantha Shea from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. We all know those people who are simply impossible to shop for. At Wirecutter, we have a huge collection of gift guides to help you find the perfect present. We can help you find a gift for the indoorsy type, a gift for the coffee lover looking to try a new bean, something that's nice but not too nice for the new person you're seeing, the best packing cubes for frequent travelers, for the music-loving dad, try a Thelonious Monk album. We believe there's a perfect gift for everyone, and Wirecutter can help you find it. Check out all our gift guides at nytimes.com/giftguides.
We're back. It's part two of the Casey cast. Laura Snapes is here. Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Laura is the deputy music editor at The Guardian. Laura wrote about Starcross, also has interviewed Casey in an earlier incarnation. And what we're hoping to talk about today, I want to talk about the full arc of how we arrived at this big energy that surrounds Casey Musgraves right now. You know, you had emailed me something yesterday that I thought was really resonant, and maybe let's start with that and work our way backwards from it. And you said something to the effect of, it's unusual that we've arrived at this big event for a Casey release when the album itself is, relatively speaking, modestly scaled. It's not a Katy Perry record. It's, you know, it's not an pop ambitious crossover record. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I thought that was actually really spot on how the scale of the record and the scale of the presentation and discourse seem to be out of whack a little bit.
I feel like the infrastructure makes sense if you think about the fact that Golden Hour won the Grammy for Album of the Year, and it also won like loads of publications, end of year polls as well. I think it probably won the Guardian's one. The expectation around this has been huge. And there's been like a big pre-release press campaign where nobody's been able to hear any music, but we've been able to hear her talk it up as this like conceptual three-part album with a sort of like Romeo and Juliet vibe. And we knew that there was this film coming, and all of those things make sense when you think, here is somebody who's capitalizing on the most successful album they've had to date, which was a surprise success, I think, but with one that is being geared to be huge. But then unfortunately, within that carapace, she comes out with this like very sad, quite small, quite enjoyably ambivalent, I think, record, which doesn't really live up to all of that kind of dressing. You know, obviously people are not going to remember the press campaign in 6 months, in a year to come, but for me it feels really misbalanced.
I think that in part has something to do with, I touched on this a little bit in my review, where Musgraves seems to occupy a place for a certain kind of, I mean, forgive me, but like a quote-unquote progressive-minded listener who, like, I don't like country, but I like Casey Musgraves. You know, Casey Musgraves is doing a thing that country music doesn't do. There's almost like a moral good in liking Casey. And I think that that's, frankly, been pretty unfair to her, because I think there's a lot of musical good in liking Casey, particularly to me, early Casey. But I feel like the Musgraves narrative maybe has been, in the public space, has been co-opted a little bit by that excitement from that group of folks. And that's what leads to a campaign of this scale, it feels like, when maybe what's happening in her mind and in her creative output is on a totally different arc.
Obviously, in the UK, we feel that really acutely because, like, no country stars break through. Casey Musgraves is the only sort of like country adjacent artist that we're talking about. And we're absolutely the sort of country that flatters ourselves into thinking that, like, we only like the progressive stuff. Like, Sturgill Simpson has a bit of profile, Margot Price has a bit of profile, but that is really about it. But then it's interesting that this record, you know, it does have a lot more of a pop sound, but it has such a strong pop framework around it. I tried watching the film this morning, but I found it incredibly boring and just sort of skimmed through it. And I don't really know who it's supposed to appeal to. It doesn't have a strong storyline. It has quite a sort of like mixed aesthetic. And it has all of these sort of like, I don't know, unconvincing pop signifiers. And I just really couldn't tell who it was for.
The film specifically?
Yeah, the film. Yeah, the film, definitely.
Yeah, let's do like 90 seconds on the film, which I watched, but I did not end up writing about for many of the reasons that you're describing right now. Okay, so I'm sure you remember how in the 90s or the 2000s, every now and again, an ambitious pop artist would be given 8 minutes of music video instead of 4 minutes of music video. And you were like, oh my God, it's literally like a movie. They've got 8 minutes and 12 seconds. They're telling a crazy story. That energy was what this film's energy was to me, except it was 45 minutes long, which is to say it did not inherently have the narrative cohesion and structure that would hold attention for that long. But it did feel kind of like pumped up versions of music video, what passes for narrative in a music video context.
I feel like whoever at the label signed off on this was like, well, it worked for Beyonce. So, you know, we've got a divorce album here. You know, why isn't it going to work this time around? But, you know, it doesn't have anything like from what I watched, the sort of depth of reference or history behind it.
It's aestheticized, right? The color palette's really interesting. You know, we've got a comedian who is well-known on Instagram, a famous TikToker. You know, we have references to certain fashion touchstones, whether it's Chanel or, you know, like a Louis Vuitton inspired type bag. Like there are little touchstones here and there, but it doesn't cohere totally from a narrative perspective. But I do think it speaks to this sense, and the rollout does give this sense, that the arrival of a Kacey Musgraves album is satisfying a huge thirst. And that thirst is so vast that simply a record alone could not fill it.
I think people have felt very let down by some of the pop girls. And I haven't had Twitter in 6 months, but I feel like even back then it was like, Kacey's going to be the one to save us. You know, there's a real savior narrative appended to it, especially once people found out that she'd got divorced as well, which is maybe distasteful. But yeah, there was hunger for it. And I feel like at first, it seemed like they were doing the press really well, like really stoking it with these big glossy magazine covers like Elle and Amanda's story and maybe one or two others. And it sounded so exciting to hear her talk about it. Like when she talked about like Buck and like guided mushroom trips and this three-part structure, it put me in mind of somebody like Julia Holter. And I realize that might seem a bit offbeat, but like she makes a sort of like prismatic conceptual music that I could see actually being quite an interesting follow-on from something like Golden Hour. Not that I thought that she would be working on it or anything, but that seemed like an expansion of the vision. And then what we actually got, which I do like, but is a real contraction of the vision.
Let's listen to If This Was a Movie. Now, in your review, I mean, this is something that I have struggled with, especially on the last Kacey record. Modest scaled Kacey is the best Kacey for me. I believe, largely alone in that opinion. You know, the critical approbation for Golden Hour is so strong, and it's probably, to me, the least effective Kacey record, but I think most people don't think that. To me, it kind of obscured what I think are her fundamental gifts, which are little songwriting twists and turns, little eyebrow arches, very, very neat structures. Like, the way you know Kacey's a traditionalist is because her structure is so strong, I think, when it comes to songwriting. Even though this album does have little flourishes, production-wise, that remind me of Golden Hour, what I like about this record, I don't love this record, but what I like about it is that the songwriting does feel taut, crisp, almost a little reluctant. It's not trying to say a lot. It's trying to say the most possible in a very tight space.
I feel like some of it does. I was thinking about like in Easier Said, where she sings about like, you know, even when I took my rocket way out to space, which I guess is an allusion to how successful she was, like I always kept my head on straight. And then she refers to the way that marriage shrunk her and like it dimmed her shine. Those moments for me are really potent, and we don't get enough of that stuff. And I feel like there's a real void at the center of the record where she doesn't want to place blame on one party or another, maybe because there is no blame. Maybe it was just a slow degradation of the relationship. But those sort of relationship dynamics, I think, are sort of few and far between in it. And I was listening back to all of her albums earlier today, and I feel like, you know, she has such a great way with cliche, but it's always in a way where she sort of makes you hear it anew.
She adds an entendre. If it's a double, she makes it a triple. If it's a single, she makes it a double. Like, that's, it's just something she's long been very good at.
Yeah, or even pairs it back. In previous records where she's talked about, like, you might expect a sort of like cliche about like, but you're beautiful as you are. She's just like, well, whatever. If people like you, like, she can dial it back as well. You know, she's always reckoned with how flawed idealism is in a really interesting way. But I feel like there are parts of this record where it feels like she's realizing that for the first time. And it's, this is what you've been telling us all along. And I guess obviously Divorce casts a new light on things. But if this was a movie, an Angel, things like that, it's like, these are pretty rote sentiments, I thought. So I don't know if I agree with you.
I think we're identifying the same thing, but we're reading different things into it. I think by the third time I was listening to it, I started to see this kind of like reluctance or kind of like bottled upness as potentially an emotional stand. It's like, I'm not going to give you any more than I've already given. It's cut and dry, even though there's narrative on the album where it's like, maybe it was me, maybe it was you, really it was you. But even though there's that kind of explicit narrative, where Golden Hour works is there's exuberance in it, even if it's not necessarily exuberance I love, but it's like there's exuberance in it, like structurally and production wise, and also to a degree in the writing. This is like, you know, sometimes you're in a breakup and you're just like, I don't really have anything to say. Like, I just, you know, I'm just, I'm tore up and I'm done. And this, there's something about this that felt like that for me.
Yeah, I didn't have space to get into this in the review that I wrote, but I felt like there was almost like a subtle kind of refusal here, in the same way that I heard in like the Billie Eilish album and the Lorde album, where it's like, she knows that you're expecting like a big, brash, sassy sort of like country breakup album. And also that, you know, Divorce is the perfect match for like a return to pure country values. And I feel like she denies a lot of that. Like, she won't give us what we want, which I think is interesting. And I respect her for it. And I respect the ambiguity in the record, but I don't know how gripping it is. Like, I think this is something that's catalyzed a lot of the reviews I've read about it. It's a really nice record. It sounds like somebody sighing, like, you know, taking off your bra at the end of the day and being like, I'm free. But I don't know how engaging it is.
Let's listen to actually to Angel, which you mentioned, which I think I agree could be read skeptically or non-skeptically. Let's listen to a little bit of Angel.
If I was an angel, I wouldn't have to try so hard to save you. Show you how to fly. If I was an angel, I wouldn't get so mad.
I can't tell if I was being kind or unkind or dead ass wrong saying that Angel reminded me of Time in a Bottle, because it's like that level of elemental schlocky pop that pops up a few places on the record, that kind of straightforward song that you cannot erase from your head, even if you are trying to erase from your head. It does seem like she's like trying to touch on that slightly. It's a less intriguing set of references than she has tried before, whether in her psychedelia phase or in her hyper-traditionalist or hyper-post-traditionalist phase. It is less interesting. I agree.
When I first heard Justified, I was like, I can't put my finger on what this reminds me of. And then I realized it was Dido. And you know, sometimes when you realize an unfavorable comparison and you're like, I can't unhear this now.
Maybe we should do a Dido episode, because low-key, I think Dido hovers over some of this younger generation of female indie pop singer-songwriters.
Dido and Natasha Bedingfield.
Strong. But yeah, I totally know what you mean. Now, if we look forward a little bit, if this record is, it's just nice, it's modest, it's deliberately reluctant, however you kind of frame it, do you think it marks an actual shift in the Musgraves narrative? Does the next album end up being a reaction to this? Or is it kind of like 10 years from now, it'll be like, huh, remember when she put out that like kind of tiny little record right around the divorce? That was a strange moment.
It's sort of more of a piece with like the two records that Taylor Swift did last year and the two records that Hayley Williams has made about her divorce as well, where it's like, these are not headline albums from these people. They're important to their catalog and they're important sort of like biographical progression, but they're not, you know, sort of like the big flashy ones. I don't really have a sense of how big of a celebrity Kacey Musgraves is in America, whether like her and Rustin Kelly's divorce was on the cover of People magazine or something like that.
No, no. Although I would sort of be amused to live in a world where that was the case. But no, I'm sure it got mentioned, but it was not on the cover, no.
What she does next sort of depends on what sort of biographical telegraphing she has to do next. And I think something that's interesting about her as well is that like, her whole thing has been defying expectations. And, you know, there's a lot she uses. I apologize for how I'm about to butcher this, but like she talks about what she isn't, what she ain't a lot in all of her songs since the beginning. I apologize. But I feel like you can only define yourself as what you're not for so long. I really embarrassed myself there, didn't I? But you can, there's only so long that you can define yourself by what you're not. And I also think that that's something that's really endemic to being in one's 20s. I think she's like 33 or something like that. And I think your early 30s, whether you're going through a divorce or not, is a real period of going, oh, I spent all this time sort of like railing against stuff. And now I actually have to sit with like, what am I and what's next? And I feel like that will probably be a big part of what comes next for her.
To circle back to what we were talking about right at the beginning of the conversation, life is nonlinear. You have huge expansive years and small insular years. Emotions are not in a clean arc, but we are in this ecosystem, especially with a star at this level, where everything has to feel like an event. And this is, I think, a hindrance to a Beyonce. It's a hindrance to a Rihanna. If you are experiencing life in a small way, in a private way, in a reluctant way, how do you make a record that's going to be received with like bugles? How do you balance those two things? Because I think certain stars are at the place in their career where they may not have an option to release a small record. That to me is why the Lord record, which I didn't love, but I think it's pretty good. But the Lord record was interesting to me because it was a choice. It was a choice to walk away from a certain aesthetic pathway and potentially some of the fans that came with that aesthetic pathway. Very few people make the decision at this level to say, I am aware that I am going to be received like a returning conqueror and I choose not to conquer, at least for an album. It's one of the real failings of internet-driven fandom being the kind of engine of a narrative. Because it doesn't allow someone to say, hey, can you turn the volume down? I just like to slip this out here. I just like to put this out. And Kacey, who maybe, you know, in the piece that Amanda wrote, is just very explicit. And she's like, I'm not trying to be a pop star. Like, absolutely not. That's not the game. But when you have this kind of built-in thirst or desire for a quote-unquote big album, whatever it is, whether it's about divorce or marriage or, I don't know, staplers and rolls of tape, like a big album. And all you kind of want to do is just be like, I just have something to say. That's tough. And again, I think it's an obstacle that level of star is wrestling with. And like I said, Lord, you get it a little bit with Billy, at least in the subject matter this year. What do you think about that? Where does that strike you?
In a way, I almost feel like it's these stars who is all pretty much young women, and they're in this position where there is so much pressure on them and they're so hyper visible. It almost feels like them putting aloe vera on a burn or something. Like, you guys talk on podcasts quite a lot about like major stars who start to behave like cult stars. And I feel like these women who are in fairly early stages of their career pretty much have sort of looked around and gone, if I am to be sustainable, I cannot continue it. You know, like, you've watched a Billie Eilish documentary. Nobody could bear that for 5 minutes and she has to live through it for like 4 years. They've gone, I need something different if I'm to be able to do this and also put my artistry ahead of any sort of like spectacle. And so I do think it feels deliberate in that respect. And I guess all of these records have been enjoyable, a little disappointing, but I have found sort of like subtle things in all of them. Like, I actually heard the Lord record for the first time when I was in my coastal hometown. And I was like, well, I too would like to drop out and go to the beach all the time. I'm here for 2 weeks. You get to do this all the time.
Wait, are you saying that the purchase of a Lord album should come with a ticket to your nearest beach town?
I literally played the stream off my phone around a campfire. And I was like, this is the perfect setting for this album. I don't know about the pop pageantry that's going on around it.
people talk about the urban-rural divide. They talk about the north-south divide in America, the east-west divide. But apparently, and I'm sorry, I know you're calling in from across the Atlantic Ocean. These may not be meaningful to you, but we are not talking about the city-beach divide. And maybe that, maybe Lord should do a tour of coastal communities, beach towns, like Margaritaville type places as a optimal setting to play these songs in.
Hell yeah.
Something to think about.
I don't think she realized how fundamentally unrelatable her position was, but I think that the small kernel of relatability in it is, over the past year, a lot of people have made decisions about wanting to quit their careers or have a totally different type of life. And that is faintly relatable in it. And I think with this Casey record as well, you know, you spend all this time in your 20s figuring out like who you want to be. And then as I have experienced it, I think Casey Musgraves is a year older than me. You spend the first part of the next decade going, how do I unpick some of this? And things which maybe other people figured out a lot earlier feel profound in a way that you, just because you haven't really thought about them before. And there is that sort of like naive sense of revelation in this record. It does feel honest. And also I was thinking like, you know, she did all of this, like, was it a mushroom trip or a plant kind of like meditation? The album is like a guided divorce meditation. Like it's almost like a simulation. It lets you experience it, like get in at one end and then drop out at the other.
Picking up on what you're just talking about, let's listen to a bit of Hookup Scene, which I think to your point is a little bit like realizing stuff 101.
Pretty face. Might get you far, but still it can't replace the kind of real connection that I crave, the kind we don't have anymore. I get in my head.
I actually very much agree on Hookup Scene and, to a slightly lesser degree, Camera Roll. Camera Roll feels like an internet personal essay of like the early 2010s, kind of. Oh no, it's all right there. You know, what am I supposed to do with this?
And it's completely depersonal. She's saying it like it's going to be helpful to somebody to sort of realize this.
And Hookup Scene, it is raw, but also like in the kind of like almost naive way of like, huh, I had no idea. That is a surprising feeling from a singer-songwriter who always has an idea. Casey Musgraves, in my mind, her best song is a hookup song. It is what it is. That to me is peak Casey Musgraves. So it's a little surprising to have a song like this, which feels like less psycho spiritually evolved than that was from the first record.
The verse is okay and that feels real, but then the chorus is just pure homily and it feels so sort of out of sorts with everything that she said before. It's, yeah, it really, really lets it down, that part.
I've noticed in a lot of reviews, not yours, not Craig's at Vulture, but there's a lot of reviews. I think, again, we're treating the arrival of every Casey record in this kind of like big, big, big thing. Like it's got to be big. It's got to be great. And maybe this is a repeat of what we were talking about a minute ago, but is that a hindrance? Is that bad? Is it okay if Casey Musgraves put out a mid record? Like, I think it's okay. Like, we're going to look back on this 10 years from now and not be like, wow, that was the beginning of the end of Casey Musgraves' career. We're just going to be like, huh, okay, well, that happened. And then whatever the next thing happened was. Can the critical discourse, and by extension, the type of fan who needs Casey Musgraves to exist, can that conversation survive amid Casey Musgraves' record?
I think so. And I would hope that it would just sort of let her get back to, not get back to basics, but, you know, be able to actually reset in a bit of a real way that sort of like tampers down some of the expectations of what came before. People put out a record and they're like, this is me now. This is everything I believe. And then 2 years later, they're like, yeah, that person didn't know anything. I guess in the same way that all of us move through life. But I'm interested in when somebody puts out a record that seems to have a real worldview, and then what happens next is challenged by it, or it has to learn from those lessons. And I think one thing that was really interesting with this record was the last album, it marked her out as, you know, a real musical trailblazer. And I think a lot of people thought that there was going to be another reinvention this time around. And I wrote this in my review, but it is really not so much of a reinvention. And I felt like that related to how when you've gone through something like divorce, you don't tear it all down and start again. You just have to sort of like slowly rebuild and learn from those lessons. It feels like a reconsolidation. And I'm interested what of the mentality of this record she will sort of carry forth, well, into her life, and then how it comes out in the next one.
I asked you the question earlier, and to be frank, I didn't know the answer, which is where does she go from here? I don't know the answer, but I think my guess, if I had to guess, is coming off of a cycle of exuberant marriage and love album followed by kind of reluctant divorce album. I wouldn't be surprised if the next album is a kind of out-of-pocket concept record that obscures biography altogether. Casey doesn't seem like the most, like, she's not overly personal and intimate in interviews, it doesn't seem. She's talking about the facts of what's happened without kind of like giving it all up, like some stars always want to tell you all the details. And I wonder if this kind of 3 or 4 year arc of putting it all out there in the music will lead to a total retreat and just, you know, the next thing is maybe, like I said, the concept record about staplers and rolls of tape, you know, like yeah. That to me feels like a real potential next step.
She is an incredible storyteller, listening to like Same Trailer, Different Park and Pageant Material again earlier. Her eye for detail and also like the dynamics of a very particular social situation, which is really easy to characterize wrongly. They're really acute. It sort of reminds me again of like Taylor Swift with Folklore and Evermore, where she kind of shifted much more into fictional or supposedly fictional songs, and she applies her gift that way instead.
Yes. Alleged fictions.
Yes.
Laura, what song do you want to hear off of this? Or maybe an old Casey song, just to kind of like spice it up to close out with.
The one that I was most struck by when I was listening to Pageant Material while running earlier, and it's really not running material, is Miserable, which is probably a bad ending for this.
No, but it also might be the most apt ending. That's our show. Thank you, Laura. Thank you to Amanda, who was here earlier. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord, which there's a link to in the Facebook group. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. There's been some really good emails lately. I appreciate that. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's feel miserable.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.